Article 26 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights states that everyone has the right to education. The Declaration of Human Rights also affirms that education shall be directed to the full development of the human personality and to the strengthening of respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms. Is this right being upheld in prisons in Canada? To help us answer this question and assess the state of education in Canadian prisons, we're going to be speaking with three people in the next hour. Lara Lisa Condello works with women at the local prison on an Aboriginal-centered educational program. She's also working with prisoners and ex-prisoners, making the connections between education and health. She joins us in about 40 minutes to talk more about some of this work. Rob Johannes was inspired by Malcolm X's story of his prison education. Rob studied the transformative effects that education can provide to those behind bars, and he joins us in about half an hour to tell us more about BC's defunct prison education program, as well as about the connections between restorative justice and education in prison. But first, we're going to be speaking with Bob Gaucher. Bob has a lot of experience with education in prisons in Canada. He is a retired professor of criminology from the University of Ottawa, and he has been active in the prison abolition movement for many years. Bob was one of the first to take university courses while serving time in prison, and he has spent many years working with lifers and teaching criminology to prisoners. Bob is also the editor of the Journal of Prisoners on Prisons. He joins us on the phone from his home in Ottawa to share his experiences and perspectives on education in prison. Welcome to the show, Bob. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening. Thanks for inviting me.
So you were one of the first people in prison to take post-secondary education. That was in the late 1960s. What was it like trying to set that up as a prisoner back then?
Well, it was really pretty much unheard of. And there'd only been one person that I'd known of that had pursued education. It was a fellow named Frank Anderson, who had got a life. He actually was sentenced to death in the mid-1930s. Because of his youth, he had his sentence commuted. And he ended up in Saskatchewan Pen. And the warden, Warden Cooper, who was really had a terrible reputation, was noted in various reports as the kind of warden that they shouldn't have in the service. Somehow he took a liking to Frank and encouraged him to go to school. And Frank started taking courses from the University of Saskatchewan in the 1940s, and actually was paroled to go to U of T. He went to University of Toronto, finished his undergraduate degree, and then got a master's degree in social work. The amazing thing about Frank is sometime in the 1970s, he actually ended up in the parole board. But when I, you know, checked the scene out in the mid-1960s, it was truly unheard of. Frank was seen as the great exception. And for me, it was really a matter of chance. I met a student who was working as a kind of volunteer counselor at South Penn. That would have been the summer of 1967. And he said, well, you know, they had an education program, an external education program at Queen's, and he'd check it out for me. So lo and behold, I got accepted in to Queen's University in 1967. I took two courses by correspondence, and I did fine in them. And so the next year I was able to enroll in three. So I finished my undergraduate degree eventually at Queen's, but I finished my first year while in the penitentiary, and then it really was unheard of at the time. It was quite a fight with the head of the library and vocational training to actually convince them such a thing was possible. Queens were great. There was a woman who ran the external education program who had a soft spot for prisoners. You know, there's the Kingston region, even back then, had quite a number of prisons. So the penitentiary was very much a noted thing in the Kingston region. And so she really came to bat for prisoners there and had started about the mid-60s, encouraging prisoners to take correspondence courses. I must say that it really led to a complete change in my circumstances and my understanding of the world.
Well, you ended up being a professor of criminology, went on to do your master's and PhD. So I'm just curious how that prison education experience connected you to this whole...
I think I was lucky in lots of ways, but I arrived at Queens in the midst of the heyday of the political left, the anti-war movement, the peace movement generally. And so the transition from being a convict to being a square John, a university student, was really mitigated by the kinds of politics that were around me. And so it was really a kind of transition. I immediately got involved in what I understood to be the root of social problems, the root of criminalization and incarceration generally. And so those things really came together around my education. I was very fortunate to meet, I think fate plays a part in these things. I was very fortunate to meet a fellow named Ian Taylor, who came for 1 year from the UK. It was the first year he taught. He taught in the social department, and I took a sociology of deviance course from him. I hadn't realized that academics and academic work had really supported the kinds of politics that I was starting to understand and become conscious of. And Ian was really able to put it all together for me in a way, to take my arguments and the contradictions that I had encountered and make sense of them in some kind of academic framework. Strangely enough, he was there 1 year and he left. But it certainly got me on the road. And I was very much taken by education. I think I was always inclined towards books. You know, I was a good student as a kid in high school and the like. I always did very well. So it was easy for me. But for me, it was really the intellectual attraction of it all that I think won the day for me. I can say, you know, now that, you know, yeah, I got out. And, I most definitely was hoping for parole and to hit the street again. I'd already done a fair amount of time. I was 23 years old. But I hadn't really made any decisions as to where I was going to go or where my life was headed. And I think the university education really drifted me, pushed me in another direction, certainly in a direction different from what my earlier life had led me towards. And so it was, a transforming experience for me. When I finished the undergraduate degree, and I did very well, and I won the prize in sociology, and I had hoped to go to the UK to do a master's degree with Professor Taylor, but I got caught between being on parole and the kinds of machinations that what was then the penitentiary service and the like got up to. They told me on the day I was supposed to actually fly out of Toronto that indeed I was not going to be allowed to go. So it was really quite devastating, but I was committed enough to education and very much taken by it, I must say, that ended up coming to Carleton and I did a master's degree in sociology there, where I was able to pursue my ideas further. And one thing led to another, and I finally did end up in the UK in 1977 to do a PhD with Ian Taylor, which was another transforming experience in terms of an encounter with the left-wing politics of Sheffield. Sheffield was referred to as a socialist republic of South Yorkshire. It was very much the heart of labor at the time. And so the kinds of experiences that I had been encountering in university and intellectually just continued on. Eventually, I've got a PhD and ended up getting hired in the Department of Criminology at the University of Ottawa, where I worked for 25 years. In fact, I've just retired at the end of last month.
Wow, that's quite the journey. And part of your journey, you ended up going back into the prison and teaching criminology to prisoners. I'm just curious what that was like and how that's a bit different than some of your experiences teaching people on the outside.
Well, the University of Ottawa, their master's program had both an MA and an MCA, which is a Master's of Criminology Applied. And it's one of the things that attracted me to the department. You know, one of the possibilities, one of the academic streams was to be more active, to be, you know, engage the community in a more direct way. So I got an invitation from, actually, Liz Elliott, who teaches at Simon Fraser. She didn't at the time. She was still a student. got me invited down to the John Howard Society group, the toxin group at Collins Bay. And so I agreed to go, but I got a proviso from the warden to be able to take a few students with me. And they just had their lights blown. Gee, they couldn't stop talking on the way home. It's a two-hour drive, eh, from Ottawa to Kingston. And so it really, you know, kind of put a bee in my bonnet, and we started a prisoners liaison group. That would have been 1984. And we started going on a regular basis into Collins Bay to the John Howard Society group. And then Richard Sobey and some of the other guys that were in the group that were lifers came to me and suggested that we start a lifers group. And so we did the liaison on the outside, and they started the infinity group. So we started going down regular once a week. And our meetings weren't social meetings. We did things. One of the things the lifers group really got into at the time, it was before the first judicial reviews, so they started to study it, to try to make some sense of it, to plan for their own reviews. So, you know, through my experience of how interested this group was in academic work and doing activism from a prison cell, I kind of suggested to them, most of them were, or many of them at least, were already taking university courses by correspondence, and Queen's had an on-site program, so they were able to take some courses there. So I went to the university and was able to talk my faculty into enrolling the 17, as it turned out, lifers into my second-year criminology theory course. And it was really, really fascinating. I was able to have students come down with me who were in the class. They taped the class lectures, so those were made available to everybody inside. And we brought speakers in. I did some lecturing myself. It was very interesting to actually talk about criminological theory with people who were the criminalized, those who had already been stigmatized as the monsters and the villains. So it was both a learning experience for the convicts, a learning experience for the students, and most definitely a learning experience for me. And we did a lot of really interesting things in the group, but they were all tied into education. This was a group of long-termers that were actually, you know, engaging life and engaging their own voyage through all the dead time that a life sentence is.
A number of those men were released and ended up getting degrees and living in community. Just curious about the connections between, you know, that educational experience in prison and then reintegration and living outside in the community and finding a place that way.
Well, there's no question that education is transformative for everyone. As a university professor over 25 years, I've watched young people have their minds changed, expanded. I've watched intellectual and personal growth of young people over a long period of time. I don't know how many young people that have come into my courses wanting to be crown prosecutors and come out as prison activists, but I think for prisoners, education is liberating in all kinds of ways. It really allows a growth. It provides something that keeps you alive while you're in prison, that keeps you intellectually alive. I mean, one of the things that's absolutely killing about long-term incarceration is the boredom, the sameness, the routine, the numbing routine of everyday life in a penitentiary. You know, it's we liken it to you know, total boredom with spasms of violence that kind of are exclamation marks over the years. So I think education really keeps people alive. It keeps them intellectually active. It keeps them engaged with the outside community. Most of the fellows that were in the lifers group are on the street. They're all doing very well. They're in responsible positions. There's quite a number of that group that are working with Lifeline, which provides services for life-term prisoners in Canadian penitentiaries. Rick Sovey was one of the original members of the group, was the first lifer in Canada to complete an undergraduate degree while in prison. I think the university also has a post-release plan is a really good one. University life, in many ways, takes the pressures off of the everyday work life that convicts experience when they're released. You know, it's a really difficult transition. People expect you, because you speak the language and you're from the same culture, to understand what's going on. But that isn't necessarily the case. You know, you take a young male who, which is, you know, the rule rather than the exception, who's incarcerated from a very early age. If he does a long period of time, what's his relationship with women, for example? Like, what's his understanding of that relationship? It really poses a lot of long-term problems. The university as a community provides an access to the community, to other people that are in shared circumstances of being students, that I think is really, really important in terms of the transition. I think it's one of the reasons why many of us feel that the curtailment of post-secondary education, education generally, of course, in the penitentiary, is so absolutely short-sighted.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you, just in terms of what's happening now in prison. What's your assessment of the current state inside Canadian prisons?
Well, I think it kind of goes without saying for many of us that have been involved over the years, is that if a program seems to work, CSC is almost bound and assured to eliminate it. And they've done that with educational opportunities. They moved away from any real focus on rehabilitation. They still pay lip service to it, but it's whatever attempts that were made in the 1960s and early 1970s to put rehab programs into place, they gave up on. And one of the few things that remained through the 1980s was, in fact, education. And they pulled all funding from it. They made it very difficult for prisoners to pursue it, if they could pursue it at all. There's still a few that can take the odd correspondence course, but it's been made to be really highly problematic. They don't really provide anything. What they're doing now is this absurd risk management analysis, which in many ways simply takes the heat off the institution and puts all the responsibility on the prisoner themselves. What we have is a situation where prisoners are responsible for their crimes and they're responsible for their own rehabilitation. Otherwise, they sit and rot, and that very much is the line. You know, CSC makes claims to other kinds of interests, but they're not apparent at all. In fact, if you look at the history of what's gone on, they've went out of their way to eliminate programs that have been successful. They constantly change whatever the management process is, but they moved away from a case management process of where long-term prisoners had to make contracts with their case management group to, you know, kind of pursue education, to deal if they had obvious problems, say addiction problems or drug use problems. They eliminated that by and large and put in mass programs that are, to be quite honest, simply bullshit. They force people into things that means that the programs themselves, if they had any chance of working, don't work, because you've got many people that are going to be there, that are simply going through the motions because they have to, which robs the incentive and the ability of those who are serious to actually take part. So they've eliminated anything like that. They now do a kind of cover-your-ass risk management, where they've really reduced the possibilities of parole. They've reduced the possibilities of any kinds of serious rehab programs going on inside.
You've been doing this work for quite a long time and continue to work with lifers. What kind of things inspire you to continue the work that you do around education and around prisons?
Well, I firmly believe, as you've noted, that people have the right to education. I think that education is very important. But I guess it's my own sense of the injustice of the experience of incarceration, the brutality of it, the way people are actually not only thrown out of the society but kept out of the society. And those little things don't go away. I mean, my own experiences as a young man were, as a youth, were such that when I look back, I think, God, where were their heads at that they'd send a 17-year-old kid for a B&E to a maximum security penitentiary? Like, what's wrong with these people? And I still think that. And, you know, my experience over the years have reaffirmed that. thing about lifers as well, I might add, is that lifers are generally one-off crimes, and they're by far the best parole risks. They often are, people that lose it, the circumstances of it. I did a major homicide study back in the mid-1970s. I looked at 4,000 files, every homicide or everything defined by the police initially as a homicide between 1961 and 1974. And, I mean, I really worked those files over a two-and-a-half-year period, and I came away with a great sense of tragedy. And, you know, there were situations where everybody's drunk and somebody, they wake up in the morning and there's a body. People don't even know who did it. Often just a real, real sense of tragedy. And so I guess my own sense of humanity is comes to bear here. And I know that people deserve second chances, that many people like Frank Anderson, who are given second chances, can really make contributions to our society. That for some, if given the opportunity, and I'm a little reluctant to say this, but for some, if given the opportunity, prison puts steel in the soul. It gives a base of experience that really inspire people to do something, to make up for what they did, or to contribute to their society. And what we do right now is we stigmatize and exclude people, and we have a process of marginalization and disenfranchisement, and we're taking mostly young working-class males, but increasingly young working-class women as well. And from an early age, we're kind of pushing them out of the society and not giving them any chances to come back in. And I know that, you know, I was seen as a member of the Walking Dead by the correctional staff at Prince Albert. So, you know, I've been there, and I understand that's not true. And that given a chance, that most young people that have been incarcerated, they do make mistakes. We all make mistakes. When they're young, you know, have a real possibility of giving something back to society, of being, you know, integrated as fully responsible members of society. So I guess it's that belief that kind of keeps me going down the line. That and you know, this lingering, what word do I use here? Anger at what I've seen, what they tried to do to me, and the number of people that I've, you know, were friends of mine that were in some way or another killed while in prison, destroyed by the whole system that's set up to somehow protect the rest of us. And that's motivation enough.
Well, thanks so much for joining us and sharing a little bit about your own experiences with education in prison.
Great. Thanks for inviting me.
We have been speaking with Bob Gaucher. He's a retired professor of criminology from the University of Ottawa, and he's been active in the prison abolition movement for many years and works with lifers in Kingston, Ontario. Bob is also the editor of Journal of Prisoners on Prisons. To find out more about that journal, you can go to their website. It's www.jpp.org.
Our babies still get incarcerated, numb in the brain like it's Novocaine, so we ain't for mine, so our culture reigns. So we roll over a shaky ridge, callbacks breaking in place, and feet in spaces that they never meant to be. I never meant to be a cause of heartache, and still wrestle inside as ill. Can't find time to chill, just spill rhymes to kill fear instilled here. We still kill.
There have been several unique educational programs set up in prisons in North America over the past three decades. The BC Prison Education Program was one of those programs. It ran for 20 years from the early 1970s until it was cut in the early 1990s. As part of his graduate studies, Rob Johannes studied the BC program along with several others, looking at their impact on prisoners and the community. Rob has also worked with prisoners through the Alternatives to Violence Restorative Justice Project, and he joins us on the phone from Coquitlam, BC. Thanks for joining us this evening, Rob.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So I know you were got into some of your studies in education in prison through being inspired by the story of Malcolm X and his experiences with education in prison. Mm-hmm. And what was it about his story that inspired you?
Well, I think that I found a lot of connections between my own story as well as the stories of a lot of prisoners that I met mostly through alternatives to violence projects in the Fraser Valley at Ferndale Institution, at Mission, and elsewhere, but also through an organization called LINC, which is Long-Term Inmates Now in Community. And I started to meet a lot of people that had done a lot of time in their life, and the story of Malcolm X seemed to just kind of capture most of what made the prison education program so successful, that being that it was, for him, it was a personal journey, and this is where we draw the distinction between prison education, which is the one that's very systematic, it's part of a mandatory program, it's a lot more focused on the goals of the institution compared to prisoner education, which is something that's participant-driven, that really revolves around allowing participants themselves to go where they wanted to go. Malcolm X's story was pretty much, you know, living a life of petty thievery and you know, he was involved in prostitution and drug pushing, running numbers through, you know, Boston and New York, and ended up getting picked up. And for him, it was a cultural exercise to discover his own identity. So it just wasn't that it was education to train him for a job. It was something that allowed him insight into his own identity, his own history. At that time, there wasn't a lot of literature for black people, written by black people in the U.S. So it was this whole cultural awakening as well, and something that he did entirely on his own, because he had a genuine interest in the subject matter, and it started from that place for him. And I think that was the same kind of situation for a lot of prisoners who were in, at least the ones that I got to know over the years, who were in this region that took part in the BC program.
And you've worked with the Alternatives to Violence program, which is a sort of restorative justice type model.
Yeah.
What connections do you see between education and restorative justice?
Well, what I sort of devised when I was looking through, a couple of decades of literature and, participant-filled research about the prison education program, was that a lot of the values that were at the basis of the prison education program are the same ones that are at the heart of sort of restorative justice philosophy. If I was to actually lay them out next to each other, you would see, number one, it's voluntariness. So no one's going into this because it's forced to, and it's often said that the first way to kill a program is to make it mandatory, make it that you have to do it. And this goes for institutions in general, so this isn't just about prison. I mean, this is about education, period. I mean, how many of us have gone through university and had a course that we had to take and dreaded it the whole time? So you have the element of voluntariness. It's based on inclusivity and participation, so that people, participants in the program or the project or the course or whatever it may be, they actually guide the process. So it's not that there's a set of outcomes that are set and that they have to go towards, and then they're evaluated on that based on a pass-fail. It's let it kind of go where the participants need it to go. It's a needs-based curriculum. Same thing with alternatives to violence restorative justice processes. It's a needs-based process. So it asks participants first, what do you hope to get out of this? And that's a really different place to start from, as opposed to a traditional punitive justice system, which says, this is what's wrong with you, this is what you've done wrong, this is how we're going to fix you, because, you know, we are the all-knowing people with the institution. This is a really different orientation. It starts from, what do you do well? What's good? And how can you explore that more? So there's that, and there's also personal responsibility and accountability, which is another one, that when you actually become a stakeholder in the community and in the process itself, the outcome and how it goes means a lot more to you. And the connection that we started to make in looking at education programs in BC was looking at the theater program at William Head, which was called William Head on Stage. When you've got a sense of ownership, okay, I was involved in writing this curriculum, or I am involved in lighting this play, I am part of the crew, I'm part of the cast, you know, you feel like you're part of a community. And that's the thing with prison, obviously. Talk to anybody that spent time there. It's a very alienating environment. And staff are often the first people that you don't trust and aren't able to, because anything that you say can be used against you, really, by staff. What also made their alternatives to violence and prison education connection was the fact that there were outsiders from the prison environment coming into the institution. In alternatives to violence, it was volunteers coming in to work alongside prisoners within the project. In the education program, you actually had people who weren't part of corrections, right? This was done from 1973 to 93, first through the University of Victoria and then through Simon Fraser University. So you actually had SFU faculty coming in to the institution. And essentially, you had an environment that was removed from the prison environment. I mean, the thing that is often said that, you know, prison isn't like Oz, you know, it's more like Groundhog Day. It's just, it's the same day over and over and over again, and you get stuck in this routine. And the education program created this space where every day was different. You know, people would go in and be able to just forget about all the day-to-day petty sort of, you know, bureaucratic things that happen in prison, and they could just focus on relationship building. They could focus on their own intellectual curiosity and taking it anywhere that they wanted to go, and being able to have dialogue with people was a huge thing. That when you had outsiders from the prison community going in, their way of resolving conflict was very different. You know, often in prison, it's through violence. In this situation, it was through dialogue, you know, and that's really a big thing of restorative justice, is humanizing all the parties, so allowing everybody to see each other as a human being. So you're not a convict, you're not what you've done, you know, you are George, or you are Susan, or whatever your name is. So it facilitates positive relationships as well, not only within prison, but in the prison environment and outside of it. And that just allows for a transition when people get out of prison. That's the thing we have to remember, is that the time you're in prison, you know, unless it's 30 years, is not a huge fraction of your life, but it stays with you forever. So making that shift from inside to outside was also something that was facilitated, largely because you had a big percentage of participants. I mean, almost 90% of people that went through the prison education program didn't go back. And that was really because they came out with a positive outlook. It wasn't really that they had... We turned education into a sausage factory almost now. It's about learning particular skills to get into a trade, whereas this was something completely different. This was people allowing to empower themselves and say, you know what, I'm worth something. And when you have that mindset coming out of prison, that makes a huge difference from those who do not. And unfortunately, that happens more often than it needs to.
So this prison education program was going on for 20 years. Maybe you can just give us a little bit more details about how it actually worked in terms of what kind of things people were learning and what kind of opportunities people were able to engage in while participating in that program.
Mm-hmm. In the BC program specifically, it was to earn a bachelor's degree. So it was a lot of English courses, humanities, sociology. There was even a criminology connection there as well. So you had over 1,000 participants in this program, and you would have SFU staff go to the prison and teach courses. So it was no different from taking a course at SFU. You know, you would have your deadlines, your midterms, your term papers, your participation marks, and all that, except it was just happening within a prison environment.
And so the Correctional Service of Canada canceled this. Why was it canceled?
Well, in the early 90s, you sort of had this conservative shift happening. And it's always a pendulum, and it goes from the left to the right. So we think seem to be going in Canada. It's steadily moving further and further to the right. But hopefully that'll change soon. What it was is there was this conservative response. You know, the war on crime was really escalating in the United States, along with the war on drugs. And Canada sort of started to follow suit. And along with that came this psychology-based initiative, you know, the cognitive skills movement, that was more focused on shaping behavior, almost, in a way. The concept, the idea, the approach of othering the prisoner started to come back. And there was also the optics of tuition fees going up. outside of prison and having people in the community complaining, saying that, well, I can barely afford education for my children, so, you know, why should these prisoners get it for free? And we've heard that line come up in so many other contexts, and when you really look at the underlying issues, it actually wasn't costing very much at all to run this program, and the benefits were really great, and it speaks to education in general. You know, this isn't really the value of education in prison. This is, what does public education mean? You know, the response to, why can't, you know, I can't afford it for my kids. Well, maybe you should be able to. You know, I mean, it should be accessible to everybody. So as correctional programming became more psychology-based, more focused on risk assessment, you know, creating charts and graphs in this very, what they perceived as a cost-effective matter, that kind of contributed to the end of the education program, to the point now where you can only do education. I mean, you can get up to grade 12. You can do your GED still in prisons. Post-secondary is really at the, it's at the initiative of the individual prisoner now, and there isn't really a structure for it in the institution. You have to do it through distance education, so you don't get the experience of being in a classroom environment with a bunch of your peers and an outside teacher. It's really self-directed, and you have to pay tuition fees, you know, just like anyone else on the outside does. So when you consider the fact that if you're lucky enough in prison to be on the maximum pay scale, you're making $6.90 a day, by the time you sort of get enough savings to afford education, you're probably at a point in your sentence where you're just about ready to get out. And you're more focused on how you're going to get your life together when you get out, and education kind of takes a back seat, unfortunately, in that regard.
Well, thanks very much for speaking with us. I know there's a lot more we can say about these issues, and we're going to be talking to Lara Lisa about some of the work she's doing with women in prison in just a couple moments. Mm-hmm. So we'll be kind of following up with some current programs that are happening in the women's prison. But thanks for sharing some of your research and work with us here on Stark Raven.
No problem. Thanks. Anytime.
We have been speaking with Rob Johannes, and he studied education in prison as part of his graduate studies at SFU, and he's also worked with prisoners through the Alternatives to Violence Restorative Justice Project.
We got a lot of work to do. We got a lot of work to do. We got a lot of work, work, work. We got a lot of work to do. We got a lot of work to do.
There aren't many educational opportunities for women in prison these days, but some women in prison, along with instructor Lara Lisa Condello, are working hard to try and change that reality. Lara's working with women at the Alouette Correctional Center for Women in Maple Ridge on an Aboriginal-centered educational program. She's doing this through her work as a criminology instructor at the Nicola Valley Institute of Technology, or NVIT. NVIT is an Aboriginal public post-secondary institute with campuses in Merritt and Vancouver. And Lara joins us on the phone from her home in Vancouver to tell us more about this program and her work with prisoners around education. Thanks for joining us, Lara.
Thanks, Emily. It's my pleasure.
So you've been working on developing an educational program inside the Provincial Women's Prison in Maple Ridge.
Yep.
How is this course set up?
It's actually part of our college readiness department at NVIT. So the women participate in two courses called Indigenous Studies 050 and 060, and it's actually accredited courses, and these courses can be used towards their Dogwood or Grade 12 equivalency. So it's part of our community capacity building at NVIT.
And you developed the course, the courses in conjunction with the women at the prison.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that process and
sure.
What?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, it was really based on an understanding that prisons don't exist in isolation. You know, I think they exist within the larger social culture. So what I did is basically went to the prison gates, and I started building that relationship with the women. So I organized some focus groups with the Aboriginal women around their educational needs and career goals and learning styles, and then basically advocated for them through a proposal that I submitted to the former warden at the jail. And this was around their desire for education that was tied to their culture, such things as their personal growth, their spirituality, and their empowerment. So the pilot project was really driven by their needs. And again, when I've implemented the college readiness courses, I actually solicit at the beginning of the courses their interests around what they want to be learning.
What has been the women's response to the setup of these courses and participating in them? What kind of things are they saying?
Well, first of all, the women love the program, and based on their feedback from the pilot, we actually they wanted to create a conventional classroom. So what I mean by a conventional classroom is that it includes registration of one cohort. We have textbooks, assignments, evaluations, you know, guest speakers, a variety of teaching strategies. So everything that you would find in a classroom in the community. Of course, access, you know, they don't have access to internet. But everything you would find in a classroom in the community, we try to implement to the best of our abilities at ACCW. And this is based on their interests, on learning around their culture, their spirituality, their healing, you know, their health, addiction, and their identity. These are some topics that have come up.
And what role do you see this kind of education playing in women's lives?
It's a huge key role for them. I'm hoping that this actually acts as a springboard for Aboriginal education in prison in BC. And really, you know, it's fitting in their needs for capacity building, such things as their empowerment. And basically, you know, they need to learn, or they tell me they need to learn about their self-identity and their culture and spirituality, you know, number one, so that they can empower themselves and their families to basically stop that revolving prison door.
And you're making some connections with education and health, and you're part of planning this upcoming conference. It's called the Canadian Prison Academic Community Health and Education Conference. What are those connections that you see, and what are you trying to achieve with this conference?
Well, I'll just tell you, those connections were based, I found, with their feedback. It's an interactive, collaborative learning environment, so I'm always getting their feedback and basing changes on their ideas. And they, you know, they've reported gains on their cultural knowledge and tradition, their self-reflection practices, and empathy for human diversity. But we've also seen that clear link between education on their culture and spirituality and their health and well-being. So, for example, I asked them to, one of the requirements is to create an oral presentation on their passion. And what we see, I've typically seen over the last two years, a pattern on their presentations. Either it's around their health or around their culture and spirituality. So we're going to continue this important dialogue around health and education, like you said, at our upcoming conference. I think it's going to be a great conference. We've had excellent feedback from the community, and we're really looking forward to it. And of course, some of the women who were incarcerated at ACCW who are now participating in the program or in the group Women Into Healing are going to be essential. Some of them keynote speakers, and some of them have submitted abstracts as well. So it's really community grassroots based.
Thanks very much for joining us and telling us a little bit about that work you're doing with the women at the Alouette Correctional Center for Women.
No problem. Anytime. You take care.
Lara Lisa Condello teaches criminology to women at the Alouette Correctional Center for Women in Maple Ridge. To find out more about the conference she was talking about, the Canadian Prison Academic Community Health and Education Conference, you can check the website www.familymed.ubc.ca, and that's /DPH.